All right, in our study of Deuteronomy, we've come to chapter 22. So as we usually do, I'll read it first. You see, at the beginning of the chapter, there are various laws that seem to be unrelated, and then the last part of the chapter has to do with sexual sins and crimes. Chapter 22. You shall not see your brother's ox or his sheep going astray and hide yourself from them. You shall certainly bring them back to your brother. And if your brother is not near you, or if you do not know him, then you shall bring it to your own house, and it shall remain with you until your brother seeks it. Then you shall restore it to him. He shall do the same with his donkey, and so shall you do with his garment. With any lost thing of your brother's, which he has lost and you have found, you shall do likewise. You must not hide yourself. You shall not see your brother's donkey or his ox fall down along the road and hide yourself from them. You shall surely help him lift them up again. A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all who do so are an abomination to the Lord your God. If a bird's nest happens to be before you along the way in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs, with a mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall surely let the mother go and take the young for yourself, that it may be well with you and that you may prolong your days. When you build a new house, then you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring guilt of bloodshed on your household if anyone falls from it. You shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed, lest the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled. You shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. You shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as wool and linen mixed together. You shall make tassels on the four corners of the clothing with which you cover yourself. If any man takes a wife and goes into her and detests her and charges her with shameful conduct and brings a bad name on her and says, "I took this woman when I came to her, I found she was not a virgin," then the father and mother of the young woman shall take and bring out the evidence of the young woman's virginity to the elders of the city at the gate. And the young woman's father shall say to the elders, "I gave my daughter to this man as wife, and he detests her. Now he has charged her with shameful conduct, saying, 'I found your daughter was not a virgin.' And yet these are the evidences of my daughter's virginity." And they shall spread the cloth before the elders of the city. Then the elders of that city shall take that man and punish him. And they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver and give them to the father of the young woman, because he has brought a bad name on a virgin of Israel. And she shall be his wife. He cannot divorce her all his days. But if the thing is true and evidences of virginity are not found for the young woman, then they shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has done a disgraceful thing in Israel, to play the harlot in her father's house. So you shall put away the evil from among you. If a man is found lying with a woman married to a husband, then both of them shall die, the man that lay with the woman and the woman. So you shall put away the evil from Israel. If a young woman who is a virgin is betrothed to a husband, and a man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he humbled his neighbor's wife. So you shall put away the evil from among you. But if a man finds a betrothed woman, young woman in the countryside, and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin deserving of death, for just as when a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so is this matter. For he found her in the countryside, and the betrothed young woman cried out, and there was no one to save her. If a man finds a young woman who is a virgin, who is not betrothed, and he seizes her and lies with her, and they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he has humbled her. He shall not be permitted to divorce her all his days. A man shall not take his father's wife, nor uncover his father's bed. As I've already mentioned, the chapter opens with a variety of laws. Verses 1 through 12 cover a number of different topics, and I'll try to go through those fairly quickly. The next section, verses 13 through verse 30, covers laws regulating sexual sins and the penalties for sexual sins and crimes. And I'll try to spend most of our time on that. Let me make some comments, though, at the beginning, just on the opening series of miscellaneous laws. The first four verses have to do with finding a brother's ox or sheep going astray. The New King James Version accurately translates in verse 3, "You must not hide yourself." But the idea isn't that you're supposed to be afraid of the ox or donkey. The idea is that you just pretend you didn't see it. You ignore the situation. Okay, and I think in a translation footnote it has an explanation of that. So the situation is that you see this lost animal, and your responsibility is not only not to ignore it, but also to exert real effort. So you're supposed to seek to find the owner. If you can't find the owner, you're supposed to bring it back to your own house. Now, some of us may wonder what we would do with an ox in our house, but in their situation, that was a common thing. They actually would have lived in part of what we would look at as the house. So it was a reasonable thing, and then they should seek out and who the owner was and seek to restore it. Now, the word that's used here is your brother's ox or a sheep, and it's probably worth reflecting just a minute on that. That may indicate to us certainly not a literal brother, but someone close by. But in fact, you see, it says in verse 2, if your brother is not near you or if you do not know him. So the indication is that it's broader than someone within your circle of friends. And in fact, there's a parallel statement in Exodus 23:4-5, where it refers to your enemy's ox and the person who hates you. So the obligation isn't simply to do good to those who do good to you, but the obligation is to do good where there is a need to do good. And this is reflected further in Leviticus 19. Remember the famous statement, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Later on in the passage it says, "You shall love the stranger as yourself," the stranger being someone who wasn't an Israelite but living among them. So those underline the fact that although sometimes people understand the Old Testament as merely reflecting love within the bonds of friendship or commanding hatred to the enemy, partly by misunderstanding what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, the Old Testament, in fact, commands them to love their enemies, and in a specific way here, which requires a significant effort. And that's the sort of thinking that's behind Jesus' answer when he gives the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke 10. Remember the man, after hearing the commandment to love his neighbor as himself from Leviticus, asks, "Who is my neighbor?" And Jesus really reflects a story which is, it's not a lost ox or sheep, it's a lost man. It's a man who's been seized. But the man who asked the question should have understood from the Old Testament that your neighbor is the person in need, the person whose ox is straying or the person who's been attacked. And it's a reminder to us in this passage that we have serious responsibilities even when we may not like the person involved. It's also, by the way, compassionate to the ox or the sheep, which is part of our responsibility as well. You could try to think of current applications. I mean, if you see someone's cat wandering around, well, you could try to find the owner of the cat, but or you could try to put it to death, following later on in the chapter. But I said that because Dave shook his head when I brought up the cat. But in fact, of course, the ox or the sheep was a valuable asset. Okay, so there's some people may think of their cats as valuable assets, but the point would be to think something analogously, like if you find a lost credit card or something like that, would be one simple comparison. So there's an obligation on us to do good, even if we have to go out of the way, and even if we don't particularly like the owner, assuming we know who the owner is. Okay, then just briefly, going on to, let me mention verses 6 through 8, because those also tie together. And these verses have to do with the preservation of life. And so they tie in actually with the discussion we've seen in the previous two or three chapters, where the sixth commandment was prominent. You may remember in the discussion about war in an earlier chapter, at the end of that it said not to cut down the fruit tree. And that was a way of preserving man's life. It's important for ecology or whatever, for preserving the structure of the land, but in the immediate context, it would be to sustain their own life. And the verses here, especially verses 6 and 7 about the bird's nest, is along a similar line. So you should act in a reasonable way. If you want to preserve life, then don't take the mother, because she's the one who has laid the eggs in the first place. But you could take the young instead. And in a similar way, verse 8 is about preserving life. A parapet would be some sort of a railing around the rooftop. Okay. Again, if you want a contemporary application, if you have a swimming pool, you should fence it in. You just need to make sure that you are providing safety for those who visit your property. And it's a serious thing. It says that you may not bring guilt of bloodshed on your household. So that, again, ties back with the things we've been talking about in previous chapters. It lets me go more quickly over it, but you can see a sort of a rehearsal of similar ideas. Then let me mention verses 9 through 12. Verses 9 through 12 have to do with ceremonial requirements, by which I mean they had a special relation to the nation of Israel and have no direct application to us. So the book of Leviticus, which we studied some years ago, has a lot more regulations like this. And they are a little bit hard for us to relate to. Most of us are probably wearing clothing that has different sorts of, says here, wool and linen mixed together. Okay, so it's a little hard for us to understand what the point is. But they were ways to show the people and to remind the people that they were separate from the nations. And that is underlined in different ways. Maybe the plowing with the ox and the donkey together is something we could relate to, because this is probably the passage Paul has in mind in 2 Corinthians 6, where he says not to be unequally yoked. Okay, so unequally yoked we can apply in our situation in terms of the marriage relationship and other sorts of entangling alliances. But more generally, it's a way of setting them apart from the nations, and so that they would see themselves as separate and the nations would see themselves as separate. The reference to the tassels in verse 12 is expanded in Numbers 15, and there it's explained that that's a reminder to them of the commandments of God. So it was a way for them to be reminded that they belong to God and He had given them His law, and again, that they were separate because they had the privilege of having God's written law. Okay, so that's about as quickly as I can go over 12 verses. I skipped one because I think it belongs thematically with the rest of the chapter. But if you know me, covering 11 verses that quickly is like a world record or something. So any comments or questions so far?
Those finders keepers.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I mentioned Gary North's commentary. He actually talks about this phrase, possession is nine-tenths of the law, and explains that it's actually misunderstood. That's not the original intent of the phrase. But yeah, it's not true, finders keepers. There's, in fact, an obligation to your brother to return it. Yes?
Do you think in the confession when they discuss the general equity of the law, that these are the types of passages that they perhaps most had in mind?
That's specifically connected with the civil law. And I think the last part of the chapter is especially focused on the civil law. And so the general equity, actually was hoping to comment on that a little bit, would mean, the penalty of 50 shekels of silver, maybe that would translate into something else in our culture. But we're to learn from the principle behind the law. It is true, though, that the confession does mention that the ceremonial law often has within it moral principles that are abiding. And so the unequally yoked would be an example of that. Some of them, like, sowing with different kinds of seed, it's hard to apply that more generally, less generally than to say that we're to be holy to God and separate
You don't think that's a prohibition against genetically modified?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you could go crazy with some of this stuff. And it's funny, you know, you read the Puritan commentators, and they say, okay, well, we don't, you know, we don't obey this anymore. They recognize even then, before the advent of such technology, that this doesn't apply directly. Okay, let's then look at the second section of the law. And here I'm including verse 5 with that. I'll explain that, but especially verses 13 through the end of the chapter, which have to do with sexual sins. So I mentioned when we began this section of Deuteronomy that some commentators more recently have tried to see a pattern in the development of Deuteronomy as moving through the Ten Commandments in order. So we've seen that holds to some extent. For example, I just mentioned the references to the Sixth Commandment dealing with bloodshed and violence. And then it would make sense that this section, verses 13 through 30, would be relevant to the Seventh Commandment having to do with sexual sins. I'm not insisting that that's a strict progression, and people who do take that view have to do a lot of explaining in the first part of the chapter. Obviously, it's not an exclusive development in that way, but there is, I think, a general development, at least so far in Deuteronomy, that we're moving through the Ten Commandments. Now, it's good for us, before we start looking at the specific laws, to step back and think a little bit about that, what the reason is that these laws are here and what the background is. So the first and maybe obvious observation is that all of these laws relating to sexual relationships, husbands and wives and children, are based on the creation order. So God created man, male and female, in the beginning, and God gave the woman to the man, and that basic background is important for the Ten Commandments. It's important for what we're talking about here. When Jesus wanted to correct the false understanding of the Jews in the New Testament, he went back to the beginning. Haven't you read? And he turned back to Genesis 1 and 2. So it's very important for us to keep that in mind, because these are not culturally conditioned factors behind these laws. Now, the application of them and the specific 50 versus 100 shekels, certainly that's culturally conditioned. But this is the way God made things, and that's an important thing for us to understand. It's important for us to understand also in light of the fact that the fall significantly damaged the image of God in man, so that all of man is affected by the fall. And in particular, all of the right and good sexual relationships that God had appointed are affected by the fall. And so when we read this, we need to understand that we're not talking about a normal situation here. Just as with any, like when you're talking about warfare, that's not a normal situation. It's because of the entrance of sin and because of the terrible destruction that sin has worked in mankind that we have this discussion at all. So it's important for us to realize that. Let me just develop that point just a little further, because it reminds us that sexual sin is tied in with a lot of other sorts of sins. And this point was, I thought, really helpful, at least to me, when we were studying last summer that book on sexual orientation, the paper that Synod had published, and talking about the claim that some people are born with a certain sexual orientation, and that means homosexual versus heterosexual. One of the points that the paper made is that sexual sin is entangled with a whole sinful nature. And you can see that just on the surface of this passage. The first account is of a man who wants to put away his wife. And so what does he do? He slanders her. Okay? So it's not limited to sexual sin. It has to go into taking a person's good name and seeking to destroy the good name of the person. And that's actually a large part of what's here. Or sexual sin is connected with violence. So the last part of the chapter talks about the case where a man forces himself on a woman. Okay? So these things shouldn't be, but that's the way the fall distorts not only the sexual relation, you might say, in itself, but man's whole being, so that the whole thing is a terrible mess compared to the way God created man. And that is shown Need I say, in our own day, Supreme Court was hearing cases just this last week on the redefinition of marriage. There's a push to question whether gender distinctions are really the appropriate way to look at the way people are made. Maybe people can be multigendered. Maybe they can move from one gender to another. All of those have to do with the basic fact that in the fall, all of life is disordered. And in particular here, that affects the civil realm as well. And as I said, the emphasis in the last part of the chapter is especially on the civil law. So we may not think about that, but the effect of the fall and the disruption and the corruption of sexual relationships affects all of society as well. And that's relevant to arguments before the Supreme Court, right? It's not just some neutral thing. It has to do with the way society is going to function. And that's, you might say, prominent, so much so that when you read the last part of the chapter, you might sort of scratch your head and say, but they're not talking about the emotional distress. They're not talking about the suffering of this individual or that. It really has to do with the way society is affected as a sin against God. But having said that, let me also emphasize up front that the gospel and the work of regeneration are not a part or unable to deal with the sexual sins that are described here. So it's possible for people to think that sexual sin is the unforgivable sin. Everything else is a nice, tidy sort of sin. You know, you can be a corporate thief, you can be a murderer, and that can be forgiven. But in some minds, the guilt of sexual sin is so strong that it's very difficult to deal with. And therefore, it's important to remember the gospel touches on this area as well. And just think of Christ and the way he dealt compassionately with people who were involved in sexual sin. Think of his discussion with the woman at the well. He didn't try to hide the sexual sin that was involved, but he was compassionate to her. I mean, he went there to meet her, to talk to a woman, and he spoke the gospel to her, and she believed and brought other people as well. And Christ has put the marriage relationship to the church as the foundation of the marriage relationship among men and women, and not only the foundation in the sense of an example, but also the source of strength and the way by which we can live. So it's important for us to realize that the gospel is relevant here too. And there's so much in here that I'll try to bring up some, but not as much as I'd like to. Maybe we can come back to it because the topic continues in Deuteronomy. But let me just say positively, the scriptures teach the goodness of the sexual relationship within marriage. I put up a few references, Proverbs 5 and 1 Corinthians 7 and so on. So that this is showing, if you will, the terrible distortion that sin brings. But that should only make us appreciate the greatness of the gift that God has given us in marriage originally. Okay. So, having said that, I'll add one other thing, which is, okay, we don't talk about these sorts of things in Sunday school. Okay, we're all supposed to blush when we hear about things like this. It is a little embarrassing. In some ways, it's embarrassing for me to talk about it. So if we all want to blush at once, we could get it over with. But the Bible talks about it because these are real situations that occur. I mean, you change the names, you change maybe the locations, but this sort of thing is still going on. And it's something that we need to think about, and apparently God has given it to us for a reason. Okay, so let me begin then with the one verse in the opening section that I think logically belongs with the discussion of the seventh commandment, and that's verse 5. A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment. So people who do this are called cross-dressers or transvestites. Okay, so there you go. There are terms you don't usually hear in Sunday school, but this is again a way that men seek to blur the creational boundaries. So man, God made them male and female, and this is a way in which men show their lack of contentment with the way God made them, or some sort of a rebellion against the created order. This is culturally conditioned in the sense that if I walked in wearing the robe that someone wears in the Middle East, you might think I was cross-dressing. Okay, so, you know, it is culturally conditioned in that sense, but people who do it within a culture, and specifically to show, or to blur, I should say, the distinctions that are made within that culture. So that's I think, again, that's all I'll say on that one verse, but that, I think, ties in. I don't think it's a ceremonial requirement. There were pagans who practiced these sorts of things, but I think it is an abiding requirement because it has to do with the creation order. Well, let's turn then to verses 13 through 30, which have a series of situations described and the legislative requirement in terms of the responsibility of the civil ruler to deal with each of them. So the longest of these, I guess, is verses 13 through 21, which talks about a man who accuses his wife, his bride, I guess we would say, and says that she's not a virgin. Okay, so that's the accusation that's brought here. And it says specifically he does this because he detests her. Okay, so he has a reason to bring this slander against her. He has married her, but he changes his mind. He wants to get rid of her. And as a result of that, the best thing he can think of doing is slandering her, saying basically he was given to her on false pretenses. She had had intercourse before he married her. Now, that would be a way to end the marriage, in his thought, at least if she turns out to have been in that situation. Well, the law says that she would be put to death. But it's important to focus, I think, on the first part of this and realize the thing the man is doing is terrible because he's slandering the woman. Okay, so again, this is difficult to talk about, but virginity is not as highly prized in our culture as it was then. Okay? The woman who was not a virgin and in this situation would basically have few options if she were put away from her husband. She wouldn't be an attractive prospect for marriage. She would probably have to live with her parents the rest of her life. This was a very serious accusation that was brought against her. And because it was a serious accusation, the penalty for false accusation was a severe one. First of all, it says in verse 18 at the end, they shall take that man and punish him. Probably the word there means corporal punishment, which means he was probably flogged. Okay, so that was that's a word that's used elsewhere and seems to indicate that. So first of all, there was corporal punishment, but second of all, he is told that he has to pay a fine. Verse 19, they shall fine him 100 shekels of silver. Okay, so, you know, I don't think on Yahoo Finance you can find the exchange rate with the dollar right now, but that was a lot of money. So, for example, at the end of the chapter in verse 29, which is a case of forcible intercourse with a virgin, the man is supposed to pay 50 shekels of silver. And that probably involves a penalty over the case of consensual intercourse with a virgin. So 100 shekels of silver was a significant fine. It's a significant fine, again, because the man has slandered a person and has really sought to steal something from the person. Slander is stealing a person's good name. And so that penalty is a fitting penalty. And the fact that he cannot divorce her all his days is to frustrate his original purpose. His original purpose was to get rid of her. If he could just divorce her later, then that would be the accomplishment of what he had hoped to do. I mentioned last week the regulation of divorce and promised that we would talk about it in Deuteronomy 24, so I'm still a couple of weeks away. I won't talk about that here, but there was provision for divorce in cases in the civil realm, in cases other than would be appropriate in terms of God's law morally. Here, in any case, he's not allowed to divorce her. Now, let me just underline both for the case where the man is slandering her and in the case where he's telling the truth that the role of the parents, and specifically the fathers mentioned here, is important. Again, it's something that is largely lost in our society, but they tended to marry at a young age, so the young woman would have been in her father's house until she was married. So he was under her oversight, and this sort of violation by going off and seeking other relationships would have been then a blemish on his exercise of authority by implication. And also simply the case that he was so involved in the transaction that either the false accusation, or if the accusation were true, would bring blame on his household. And that's why, in the case that she had had sexual relations before, she is stoned at her father's house. And it says she's played the harlot in her father's house. So the emphasis on the strong role of the parents, and especially the father, is mentioned here and later on in the chapter. It's an important part of Israelite society. I would argue it's still should be an important part of our dealings as well, but it plays a significant role here. Let me go on to the other cases and we'll see if we have comments. They are related to each other, and to that extent it's okay for me to just keep talking. So verse 22 is a statement of condemnation of adultery. Specifically, it's a man who has intercourse with a married woman, someone he's not married to. And the penalty is the death penalty. Both of them will die. Now, this death penalty for adultery is repeated elsewhere, put up Leviticus 18 and also Leviticus 20. And it's, of course, a violation of the seventh commandment is directly stated, you shall not commit adultery. So it's a pretty clear connection with the seventh commandment that's mentioned here. We may wonder what that would have to do with the larger society. And again, there are lots of connections that you can make, but maybe one you wouldn't think of immediately is that society was largely structured around the inheritance of land from one generation to the next. And so if a woman married to a man has intercourse with another man, then the child that she might bear with the other man would share in the inheritance that the legitimate children were supposed to have. So this would dilute the inheritance of the legitimate children, in effect stealing their inheritance from them. So it has a significance beyond what we might immediately think of in terms of breaking the marriage bond. Obviously, that's a significant thing. But I'm trying to emphasize the relationship to the society and the civil aspects that make this a crime of that magnitude. And it's, again, it may be hard for us to understand in a society where the inheritance doesn't go by land that way, but it's still a significant factor and something I think we could relate to if we think about it. It had other aspects that impacted society. All of society would be disrupted if this sort of cheating went on, if that's the right word for it. And it's especially important, as I mentioned already, because God uses the marriage relationship to show his care for his people in the New Testament, Christ and the church. Let me move on then. Let's try to tie these together to verses 23 through 27, which talk about two cases of sexual intercourse. Here, the man, not with a married woman, but with a betrothed woman. Okay, so we did stop and think about this a little bit. So they had a system of betrothal. It's not really the same as our system of engagement before marriage. It was a significant commitment. I think this came up in connection with going to war. We said if a man had been betrothed, but he hadn't been married, then wasn't required to go to law. Betrothal period was a significant period, but it was a commitment that was serious enough so that the treatment of the man who had intercourse with a betrothed woman is the same as the treatment of the man who had intercourse with a married woman. So under law, both of these were punished by death, which underlies the significance of the betrothal commitment. Okay, so with that background, we can look at the two cases. The first case is in verses 23 and 24, and that's what I guess we would call a consensual relationship. Okay, so I told you this is very uncomfortable to discuss, but this is a consensual relationship. Here it refers specifically to the situation where this happens in the city. And it says, because the young woman didn't cry out, it must have been a consensual relationship. The law doesn't try to cover exhaustively all kinds of situations. Here it gives two very simple situations. Either the relationship, the event occurred in the city, or it occurred outside of the city. Okay, so it's not something special about living in the suburbs or something like that. It has to do with whether there were means to deliver this young woman out of the attack that she was under. And here, in verses 23 and 24, the implication is that it was a consensual relationship. Because it happened where other people would have been nearby. Okay, so in that situation, both of them are to be put to death. It's treated as if it's adultery, just like the verse before. Okay, the second situation that's described, though, in verses 25 through 27, has to do with a case where the event occurs in the countryside, and this is a sexual assault. It's a rape. Okay. I remember reading when I was in high school an editorial in which the man said that the word rape used not to appear in the papers, and now people use it all the time. So I guess I will use it as well. It's a serious thing that's described here, but the man attacks the woman and forces her to have sexual relationships. And in this case, she's a betrothed woman. Only the man is to be put to death. Okay. It's interesting and important for us to note here that the woman is not blamed at all. In fact, the woman is treated simply as a victim. She's compared to a victim of a murder, in fact, at the end of verse 26. This is important because in the discussion about sexual assault, which is a hot topic on campus, you can see lots of discussions about this, and obviously there's a lot of background in terms of feminists arguing. But there is a significant point, which is that often women who are assaulted sense guilt, and in many cases they sense guilt that they should not feel. And here the law underlines the fact that the woman in this situation is not guilty. She is like a victim of murder, and so should be treated in that way. The last example that's given, the last situation, and verses 28 and 29, and I may not get to verse 30. It's sort of a rather different case than what we've been looking at. Has to do with the woman who is a virgin. Okay, so you can see a progression in the law here. First, it had to do with a married woman, and then a betrothed woman, and now here's a woman who's not betrothed. So not only a virgin, but also not even betrothed, it says in verse 28. This also seems to be a case of sexual assault. It says he forces her, in verse 28 it says he seizes her and lies with her. So it seems to be a case of sexual assault that's described here. But the treatment of the woman is different. The treatment of the case, I should say, is different. And okay, this seems maybe rather strange to us, but the significance again goes back to the fact that the woman who is in a situation like this, who has no husband but has experienced this, has few recourses. She would not be considered a marriageable prospect in that society. Okay? I'm not saying that that's good or bad, but that was simply the way they looked on women who had gone through this situation. And so the provision that's made is that the one who assaulted her should be required to marry her. Okay. Now, you may be thinking, if you've thought about things like this before, that there's a similar situation, and there is, described in Exodus 22. In that situation, it seems that there's not, that there's consent. Okay, so that would be a case of what we would call fornication. There was no force applied in that situation. Here it's specifically mentioned that he seizes her, and so it seems it's not a consensual relationship. But in both cases, the provision is made that the man is required to marry the woman. Now, it says specifically in Exodus 22 that if the father approves. Okay, so obviously there are some people for whom the father would say, no, you're not going to marry my bride, my daughter, even though you have already had sexual relationships with her. You're not going to marry her. And the person was required to pay a penalty. Basically, he would pay the bride price because he had already, in a sense, had the had her as a bride, but he wouldn't have the benefit of having her as a bride for life. Here there's a significant penalty, as I've already mentioned in verse 29. 50 shekels of silver was a lot to pay, but he had no, you might say, he had no no recourse. He was forced to marry the woman if, in fact, the father consented to that. So probably the 50 shekels was not the usual bride price, but the bride price with a penalty attached. Okay, so maybe here I should step back again and give a little bit of cultural background. I could have done it all at the beginning, but maybe as it comes along. What is the bride price idea anyway? It was a provision that the husband made to the father in some sort of exchange, shekels or perhaps in cattle. They still do that in cattle in Africa, I think. But it was a provision that was to be made in preparation for taking a woman as his wife. And there's some indication in the law that this was for the woman's benefit, so that if something happened to the husband or if the marriage relationship were severed, then that bride price would go to her to support her. If you think back in the situation of Laban and his two daughters, Rachel and Leah, remember at one point the daughters complain to their husband that their father has wasted all of the bride price. Now, why would they care? Well, presumably they would care because it would be theirs if anything happened to their relations, their husband. And so this is a provision made to care for the wife in case something went wrong in the marriage. Now, again, when we look at a passage like this, we don't see anything addressing the emotional pain of the woman involved. We don't see a description that fits with some of the larger ramifications. But the law is specifically seeking to address structure in society. So let me come back to that point again just as we close the discussion of these verses. The whole passage is very unpleasant to think about. I hope you notice that. It's also very uncomfortable to think about. But it's here because this sort of thing happens. And because we often only focus on the interpersonal relationship and don't think about the larger effect on society. And so all of the penalties here are here for a reason. It would require a good bit of thinking to understand what the reason is and how that would translate to our own day. I'll mention a book that belongs to the church library, The Shadow of Christ in the Law of Moses by Vern Poitras. He does spend a good bit of time here. He realizes it's difficult to figure out exactly the implications for our civil system, but he does try to see how that would carry over. So I'd encourage you to look at that. Other people have attempted the same thing. But I think it's significant for us to realize, so not to be too political, but to go back to the discussions in the Supreme Court in the last week, that what we call merely personal relationships, or we say, well, the injured party is just the husband or the wife, when we say that, we're failing to realize that God has placed marriage in society in a way that ties lots of things together. And so these crimes and these sins have a significant effect on society as a whole. Okay, let me close just by coming back to the gospel message, because this is pretty dreary and discouraging and a very unpleasant thing. It is a striking thing that when God's people repeatedly rebelled against him in the Old Testament, when they were sent into exile, or when they were about to be sent into exile, he often called them back to himself. And what's striking is the way he called them back to himself. He says, "You are an adulterous wife," because they had played falsely with him. They had worshipped other gods. They had gone astray from him. But he doesn't stop there. He also says, so look at the book of Hosea, for example. You're an adulterous wife, but I'm going to take you back to myself. So that was worked out in Hosea's life in a way, concretely, where his own wife had gone astray and committed adultery, and he was called to bring her back. But the significant thing for us understanding our relationship, not only in terms of sexual sins, but whenever we rebel against God, is to remember that God loves the unlovely, God loves the unfaithful, and specifically in sexual sin, God shows mercy and restores people to himself. So God uses one of the most detestable sins in terms of adultery being a breaking of an intimate covenant, and says, though that has happened, yet I will restore you to myself, to emphasize his mercy shown to his people. I didn't want to stop on such a grim note. I hope that will be helpful. Any comments or questions on the chapter as a whole? Bruce, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Some of this inform from a church discipline perspective? I mean, because like excommunication would be like the death penalty.
Yeah, I think so. I didn't get to verse 30. Verse 30 is a case of incest, which is specifically mentioned in 1 Corinthians 5 as a matter for church discipline. And there, the church doesn't have the sword, but that was a crime punishable by death in the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, the church, it was still dealt with, but dealt with by excommunication. That's right.
Well, just, because part of the discipline is being unfaithful. The church member playing the harlot in the
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Going after other gods and
right.
And being unrepentant.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, right. So there would be an analogous thing. And certainly in the case in, for example, in 1 Corinthians, there was every effort made to restore the person. And apparently from 2 Corinthians, the person was restored. So an example of God showing mercy there and restoring. But yeah, I think there are parallels which can be applied in the New Testament church, as long as you realize the church doesn't have the sword, but still is to seek to discipline, ultimately seeking the purity of the church and the restoration of the sinner. Is that what you were getting at?
Or, yeah.
Yes, Jeff.
To what degree was the death penalty a maximum penalty?
Right.
You can think of the cases in the Old Testament where something like this happened.
Yeah, so that's a good point. The law at one or two points says with regard to murder that you can't reduce the penalty, in effect. And that seems to imply that reduction of penalty could be provided in other cases. So in the case of adultery, the husband presumably could intercede on behalf of the wife and ask that the death penalty not be applied to her. That would be a specific case that people who have studied this a lot more than I have that understanding, that the death penalty was a maximum penalty but not required except in the case of murder. Is that you read?
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. God doesn't tell Hosea don't have her.
Right.
It doesn't give explicit instruction. He just says to take her back. But,
yeah. I think I mentioned this. I think this came up. Last week, I guess, with regard to the rebellious son. I think I mentioned that was a maximum penalty, that execution. But I think that's probably the case, but it requires some study to get to that point. Yes, Dan.
We already emphasized this a bit, but it's remarkable how perpendicular this teaching is to the culture we live in, where I was thinking of the hyper-emphasis today on the individual in our culture. So right. This covers the earlier portions as well as the adultery, anything else, everything from cross-dressing to homosexuality, anything else. Our culture seems to be dedicated to the notion of whatever makes me happy. There's really no way to enforce anything outside upon me. It's whatever makes me happy is surely okay. But the scriptures seem to make it very clear that a lot of other people are affected by what I do. And then the culture at large and the structures that are all quite dependent on that. It's much bigger than just what makes me happy.
That's an excellent point. Yeah. Good. Well, it's not good, but that's... Okay. Well, let's close in prayer.